ACB Radio is brought to you by the American Council of the Blind. If you would like more information about the council, visit their website at www.acb.org. That's www.acb.org. ACB, the people that bring you ACB Radio.
Don't risk the disappointment of missing a great ACB radio program. Join our announcements list today. Receive email about upcoming programs on all our channels and new features. To join, send a blank email now to announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
That's announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
Or visit our website. Announcements about ACB Radio delivered to you direct and free. Just another way to stay in touch with ACB Radio.
Programming on ACB Radio is made possible in part through financial support from the Verizon Corporation. Verizon, a proud supporter of ACB Radio.
ACBRadio.org.
Hello there and welcome to Blind Line, the original interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. I'm Jonathan Mosen. It's a pleasure to have you along. And today, in just a moment, we're going to talk about a subject that's very dear to many of us, and that is sleep, or lack of it. And we're going to be talking about some research that is being done into the sleep patterns of totally blind people. And I have to say that I don't think I have ever received so much email about a Blind Line program in advance of the show before as we have on this whole question of blind people and the difficulty many of us have sleeping. I had a bad night last night, in fact, so it's very timely that we bring in our guest today, Dr. Stephen Lockley, who has been on the show with Marlena in the past on Blind Spot, and that show was popular. So, Stephen, it's really great to have you back on the program, and thank you for your time this Sunday evening.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here, and I'm glad we've got the opportunity to talk more about sleep disorders, because it is such a big problem.
Yeah, can we start with the very basics? I mean, how much sleep do we need? You know, they used to say 8 hours sleep and 8 hours work and 8 hours play. Is that in fact the case for everybody?
It wouldn't be a bad start, but there are individual differences. There are differences between people. We think that the best amount of sleep people can get is somewhere between 6 and 9 hours. And that can vary between people. And we don't quite know why that varies between individuals. There may be a genetic link. And we're still trying to do studies to work out why some people seem to do very well on 6 hours, but other people tend to need a bit more. But somewhere between 6 and 9 hours, on average somewhere around 8 or 8.5 hours would suit most people.
Is it possible to oversleep?
It's a good question. There's been some surveys done of people who sleep much longer than 9 hours and looking at diseases and other types of problems that those people have. And there seems to be a link with very long amounts of sleep and very short amounts of sleep and some mortality rates. It's all out, it's not a definite link, it's only an association between sleep times and death rates. But people who sleep for a very long time seem to have more problems than people who sleep between the 6 and 9 hours.
And I suppose it's a little more easy to work out what happens if you don't get enough, but presumably there are health dangers as well as occupational hazards in being on the job when you haven't slept sufficiently.
Yes, that's a big problem, and there's been a lot of research looking into shift work sleep disorder, which is a similar type of problem to the one we're going to discuss tonight in totally blind people, but it's where the body clock's working at a different time to when you want to work. And most of the accidents that happen in motor vehicle accidents or shipping accidents or even nuclear reactor accidents, things like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, were all associated with people working a night shift and not being maximally alert when they were at work.
It's a subject that has always fascinated me, the subject of why blind people seem to have so much problem sleeping, or why so many blind people seem to. And myself, being blind since birth and having no light perception, I can very much personally relate to this in the sense that right through school and on to university, no matter how hard you try, you could go to sleep, you know, at a reasonable hour, 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening because you're dead tired, sleep for about 2 or 3 hours, and then you're up again maybe for 4 or 5 hours in the night, and no matter what you do, it doesn't seem to make a difference. You can't go back to sleep again. And then just about morning time, when you have to get up and continue your daily life, that's when you seem to get tired again, and it overpowers you about lunchtime, and no matter what you do, you can't stop yourself from slouching on the desk or whatever. And from the feedback I've received in the email over the last few days, that seems to be a very common story.
That's exactly right. They're the type of symptoms which would expect from people without any light perception. And this is due to a disorder called non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder. And the reason this happens is that all of our body rhythms are kept on a 24-hour day by the light-dark cycle. And some experiments were done over 70 years ago now where sighted people were put in a cave with no idea of what time of day it was and no light. And their body clocks started to run on a day different from 24 hours. On average, it's around 24.3 or 24.5 hours long. And this is exactly what happens in totally blind people. Their body clocks lose the information about the 24-hour light-dark cycle, and then they start to run on their own genetic, a genetically determined body clock time. And that can range from people who have clocks which are slightly shorter than 24 hours through to people who have body clocks which run on nearly a 25-hour day. And this continual cycle of running on a day length slightly different from 24 hours brings the symptoms that you were talking about, where people have a great deal of difficulty keeping in sync with 24 hours and end up going through cycles of very bad sleep with lots of daytime naps and bad sleep at night, and then run into a good phase where everything's okay for a while, and then start to run out into a bad phase again because the body clock is running at a different time to the 24-hour social day that we all try and live on.
I started reading a lot in the early 1990s about melatonin and the fact that the presence and absence of light seems to regulate the supply of melatonin, the secretion of it from the pineal gland. Does that mean then that because blind people don't have light perception, even if they go and try and deliberately expose themselves to a light through lamp or natural sunlight, that it's not going to make a difference?
In the majority of people, that's true. It won't make a difference. The melatonin is always produced in the dark. It's always produced at night in a diurnal animal, an animal that is active in the daytime like humans. And melatonin is the body's signal to tell it when to start to shut down, to tell it when night is there, to tell it when to go to sleep. And in totally blind people, the melatonin rhythm is still perfectly normal, but because it's running on a day different from 24 hours, it's telling your body to go to sleep on a 24-and-a-half-hour pattern. So every day, half an hour later, telling your body that now it's night time and now it's time to go to sleep. So this is why people experience this cyclic disorder where their body's trying, for example, trying to tell them to go to sleep at midnight tonight, midnight 30 tomorrow, 1 o'clock in the morning the day after that, 1:30 the day after that, and so on, in this continuous cycle where people go round and round. Now, there are a very small number of people with total blindness for vision who are still sensitive to light. And some work done by the laboratory I work in at the moment at the Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard Medical School showed that 4 people have the ability to sense light for their body clocks but are unable to see light for any vision. And more studies have been done to see if more of these people exist, and there's only ever been 4 people worldwide found with this type of property. So the majority of people with no light perception are not sensitive to light at all, but there are a very small number of people who manage to use light to keep their body clocks on the 24-hour day.
Now, there seems to be all sorts of debate about whether it's appropriate, whether we have sufficient information to take melatonin orally to try and beat yourself back into a good circadian rhythm. Not long after discovering melatonin, I discovered the antidote, which was having children and crying babies in the middle of the night, which was most unfortunate, having just discovered melatonin. But it does seem to work for a number of blind people. That what I find works for me now, in fact, is just to take maybe 2.5 to 3 milligrams whenever I'm starting to go off the rails sleep-wise, rather than taking it every night. And that seems to provide correction. Do we have enough information to be able to say to blind people, yes, you should do this, or are we not aware enough of the risks or benefits?
There are 2 points. There was a lot of research done in the 80s and the early 90s where people were given melatonin just at bedtime. and totally blind people did have some success when they took melatonin at bedtime. It helped some individuals and not others. Since then, we've done more research into this, both at the University of Surrey in England, where I used to work, and there's a group working in Portland, Oregon, Dr. Al Louie and Robert Sack, who some of your listeners may have heard of. And we've both done similar studies where we've given various doses of melatonin, but the melatonin's been timed according to each individual's own body clock. So we think that it's not just good enough to give it at bedtime, because what your bedtime, even though, for example, your and my bedtime might be the same, it might be a different time for your internal body clock. So we need to know, first of all, the timing of each individual's clock before we can tell when to start melatonin. And your anecdotal evidence that you start to take it when you start to come out of a good phase and into a bad phase is exactly the type, exactly the right circadian time, the right body clock time, when we would predict to take melatonin to have its maximal effect. The problem with melatonin, it's a chronobiotic, which means it's a drug which can have different effects depending on the time of day that you take it. And the problem with melatonin, it can shift your clock forward and it can shift your clock backwards. So if you take it at the wrong time according to your body clock, you can actually make the problem worse by taking you to an even worse time. So it's very important that melatonin isn't just taken as a sleeping pill would be close to bedtime, but that it's timed accurately according to each individual's body clock. And because everyone's clock is different, then it takes a bit of work before you can work out exactly when to take it. But as a general rule of thumb, your own experiment to find that it works best if you take it just as you're slipping out of a good phase would be a good approximation and a good place to start.
So can an individual work out through their own methodology when the appropriate time is, when their bedtime is for melatonin, or is that something that one really needs the assistance of a professional who understands it better?
The rule of thumb would be that you monitor your own sleep somehow, using a sleep diary or just recording when you go to bed or when you wake up, or when you even have daytime naps. Daytime naps tend to be a very good indicator of this type of disorder. And if you can work out the timing of your own cycle and how many days it takes to complete one full cycle, that's a great start. And then the first thing would be to try and take it just as you are going out of a good phase, so just as you're slipping into a bad phase. And this might feel like you're having trouble getting to sleep at night, you're feeling very tired in the morning, and maybe having some naps in the morning. And that would be the time to maybe start taking it around bedtime, maybe 9 or 10 p.m. And this would hopefully have the effect of bringing your clock forward slightly and locking it onto a normal night time. The problem with that is if you get it slightly wrong and the clock continues to carry on running, then it may be best just to stop the treatment, let the body clock get back to a good phase, go through the good phase again, and then maybe restart melatonin treatment as you're slipping out of a good phase. The other way to try and do it on a more professional level is to measure some of the hormones that are controlled by the body clock, and we can measure them in urine samples, so it doesn't need any invasive procedures. And by measuring urine samples over several weeks, we can work out the timing of your body clock, and from that predict when would be the best time to start the treatment.
So the first method you mentioned, is this what people mean when they talk about keeping a sleep diary? I've heard that expression used.
Yes, a simple sleep diary would be good to try and work out how long it takes you to go through one full cycle of this body clock disorder. And the simple thing to do would be to just keep a record of the time you go to bed, the time you fall asleep, any time, the number of times that you wake up in the night, when you wake up in the morning, and then whether you have any daytime naps. And if you plot that over weeks and weeks, you may start to realize the timing of the cycle and how many days it takes you to go from one good phase through a bad phase to the next good phase. And often that's a very good predictor of the length of your cycle and then what your body clock time is, your internal body clock time is. And from that we can maybe predict when would be the best window in which to start melatonin.
Now we also hear in the mainstream media that people are taking melatonin to relieve the symptoms of jet lag, which I guess are the kind of symptoms that many blind people live with on a regular basis. A blind person who travels internationally and also gets jet lag, that can be one heck of a mess to sort out.
Well, the jet lag is a similar type of disorder where people's body clock are on one time and they're trying to live on another time. And you can maybe think of the non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder that blind people have as a type of permanent jet lag. Instead of, they're continually, in a way, travelling around the world, and just flying round and round and round. The symptoms that people have for jet lag are often the same for people who have this non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, so that sleepiness in the daytime, maybe some gastrointestinal problems, other types of problems in alertness, staying awake in the day or feeling alert and be able to perform and perform well at work, for example. So those are exactly the types of symptoms, and melatonin has been used to treat jet lag disorder and has been used to treat people who have a shift work problem. But again, the same problems apply to melatonin for those disorders as they do for blind people, because it can have an opposite effect depending on what time of the day you give it. You really do need to know the time of your internal body clock before you start to take melatonin to correct that. And often people take melatonin to treat jet lag and may take it at the wrong time, and may in fact make their jet lag worse. So it's not as easy as taking it just to go to sleep. You really do have to time it to your body clock, and that's been the difficulty with use of melatonin for these types of disorders.
Dr. Stephen Lockley is our guest, and if you'd like to give us a call, the number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800, and when you're asked to enter a conference code, it's 0480-5512. Someone has done just that, so we'll take that call. Good evening to you.
Good evening, and thank you. This is an interesting discussion, always is, because, of course, it does seem like for those of us who are blind, sleep is somewhat evasive from time to time. I'm wondering, do you have any feeling as to the effectiveness of the CPAP machine for sleep apnea? I've just gotten on one, and, you know, I don't mind. I mean, I obviously have more deep sleep during the night. I can, you know, my partner can tell that, but I hate the mask on me and the pipe, you know, the thing coming off my head. Yet I'd prefer that to surgery that they, you know, talk about. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, sleep apnea is a completely different type of condition to the one that is caused by a body clock disorder. Sleep apnea can happen in anybody. It can happen in people with and without sight. And it's a disorder of breathing while you sleep. And some of the reasons for why that happens is people may have a thinner windpipe than other people, which then when they go to sleep causes some problems and stops air from getting to the lungs, and then the breathing stops, the heart starts to slow down because the breathing stops, and then the person takes a big breath to try and recover the oxygen that they've lost. So it's a completely different disorder from losing light perception. And CPAP, which means continuous positive airway pressure, for people who don't know, and the CPAP machine is like a mask that you put over your nose and mouth, and it in effect forces air down your windpipe to make sure it stays open so you don't have the windpipe closing, and then you can breathe normally during sleep. It's a very successful treatment. You probably, as you said, you probably have better sleep. You said you had deeper sleep. And the good thing about it's a non-invasive treatment. It doesn't require you to have any surgery. You just wear the mask, and it helps you stay keep your airway free. Of course, the problem that you've mentioned is that it's sometimes difficult to get used to, but because it's such a good alternative to surgery, many people opt for it. So from a point of view of curing the sleep disorder, it's very good. It cures the symptoms of the sleep problem, but it may take some time to get used to wearing the mask and to fit it into your routine.
Well, like Jonathan, I had tried the melatonin for a time, and no, I noticed no difference at all. Nothing whatever. Didn't, you know, I might as well have taken swallowed an M&M as opposed to the pill. So, and then, you know, we finally decided in my particular instance that this might be what was going on. And
well, it's possible that melatonin, melatonin wouldn't be a treatment you would choose to treat sleep apnea.
Was when I thought it was just strained, my circadian rhythm was
right. But it may be that that two disorders are going on. There's no reason why you couldn't have a sleep apnea and as well have a circadian rhythm disorder. And it may be that the sleep apnea is sort of the worst of the two and has the worst symptoms, so treating that would be the first thing to try and do to reduce that.
Yeah, I didn't really think the circadian was an issue because I can see nothing else, but I do have light perception. Have no other vision,
right,
whatever, but I do see light.
And from the work we did previously, we did study many people with just light perception but without any vision, and it seems that even a small amount of light perception is enough to reset the clock. So having light perception in the majority of people means that their body clocks are completely normal and that they don't have this body clock disorder that we talked about, that really is only in people with total blindness.
Well, thank you for your work in this. I think it's fascinating.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. And the board's lighting up. I imagine it is. Not having light perception, I couldn't actually tell you. Area code 812, hello there.
Hello. I'm curious if you've done any studies on people whose sleep-wake cycle has been altered for after eye surgery. I had a unique situation where I had a silicone sphere implanted in the left eye, and it only held for 33 days, but during that time my sleep was radically changed. Went from, I guess what you call an owl to a lark.
Right.
You know, waking up every day with the birds at 4:30, being much more alert, just a lot of positive changes that took place until the sphere was rejected by my body.
And did you have any light perception in the other eye?
No.
Right.
No light perception.
There have been some reports. I haven't personally studied people before and after surgery, but there have been some studies done in the early 70s looking at that. And we would expect that, of course, if you had eyes before surgery and then had eyes removed, then there's no chance that the eyes could be doing anything for the body clock. There's no way that light could then get to the body clock. So we would suspect that people who had their eyes removed may then develop this type of sleep disorder if, in fact, their eyes were working to give light perception for the body clock before then. The other thing that keeps body rhythms in check are social cues, things like keeping a schedule and making sure you do the same things at the same time every day. And, of course, these may be disturbed as well before and after surgery, so it's often difficult to tell whether it's a disturbance of any light perception or subconscious light perception, or whether it's a change in the what's called the non-photic or the non-light time cues, such as having a regular sleep-wake cycle or going out at the same time every day or having meals at the same time every day. So often a surgery is a very disruptive procedure, and a lot of these things change at the same time, and we don't know which one is particularly important. But we would suggest that people who have eyes, even though they have no light perception, they may still be doing a function, they may still be doing a job and perceiving light for the body clock, even though you can't see light for vision. So we would recommend carefully assessing body rhythms before and after surgery, and if your eyes are working to give you subconscious light perception before surgery, then unless there's an extreme pain or a good medical reason to remove the eyes, then we would maybe consider not removing the eyes, but we would have to check that before that recommendation could be made.
Well, actually, my eyes had already been removed for a year due to atrophy and calcification, so this was a situation where the eyes had already been removed.
But right, I can't explain that. I don't know why the addition of a particular type of eye would improve the body clock. There may be another reason, but there's no way that light information could go via the eyes to the body clock, and we know that that's the only route into the body clock. People may have heard of light at the back of the knees or light going through the skin to reset rhythms, and there's some experiments coming out now which show that that isn't true. Light doesn't go through the skin in order to reset your body clock. It does have to go through the eyes. But I'm afraid I can't explain why the addition of a different type of prosthesis would help you sleep better.
So you haven't done any studies of people who have had eyes and then done follow-ups after their eyes had been removed?
No, we haven't. We've studied people with and without eyes, but not the same person who's had their eyes, and then we've studied them later. We do keep in contact with the people that we studied in the UK, and if that was to happen, then we would be in touch with them, we would study them, but those type of people haven't come to our attention yet.
I have done studies with eyes at Brigham back in 1994.
Right.
That's something that I never wanted to pursue at some point. I think that's fascinating.
That would be wonderful.
That there's no chance after the eyes had been removed, but after this particular experience I had, you can't convince me otherwise. The changes were too profound, and they were directly related to the insertion of the silicone sphere change after its removal.
It would be wonderful to do an experiment. We could maybe get in touch after the show and talk about that. As I said before, there are other reasons why body rhythms can change, and other things are these non-light time cues, and it may be that the influence of those altered before and after the surgery, but without doing some tests, we couldn't say.
Good. Well, make note of your email address when you give it, and we'll contact you.
Thank you very much.
Good. Thanks, Michael. See you later. Area code 802 now. Hello there.
Hi, how are you? I've got a question about bleep and possibly comparing it to the eye poking, because I still do that. I did it since I was two.
Interesting.
And,
are you familiar with that, Stephen? Just asking Steve if he's familiar with that congenital habit that many blind people have of poking
their eyes. If it has anything to do with sleep, as far as not very well and things like that. Because like I said, I do it. I've been doing it since like I was two, and I've been having a lot of problems sleeping. Sometimes I'd even wake up at 3:30 in the morning, maybe even earlier than that. And I also have had some medical problems too. So I mean, I'm just wondering if the eye poking has something to do with it.
I haven't heard that that would cause sleep disorders. Although it's good to mention that many things cause sleep problems, not just a body clock disorder.
Right.
We've already heard of the sleep apnea, which is a condition that anybody can develop. But there are many other reasons why people develop sleep disorders, certain psychiatric problems or things going on in their family life, or many other medical problems do cause sleep problems. Mm. So it's good to point out that not every blind person has a sleep disorder has a body clock disorder. Mm. And if there are other medical problems, then that might influence sleep. The important thing to think about for a body clock disorder is whether it's happening on a cycle, whether you're having the same, you're having sleep getting later and later and later every night. Well, there are some people who are permanently owls or permanently larks, and they also have a problem with their body clock. And it may be that people who repeatedly wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning have their clock set to a slightly earlier time, and that is a body clock disorder. But whether any other conditions are affecting sleep, we wouldn't know unless we did an assessment.
Right. And, went to bed, during the summertime I'd go to bed at around 2, 3 in the morning. End up getting up around 10, 10:30. I could not go to sleep early at night. I had to get up, I had to move around. It was something else, and I think it happened to me during daylight savings time. And how can that affect?
That's a great question, and daylight savings time has a bigger effect on all of us than we probably realize.
Right.
If people have light perception, or if you have this subconscious,
I do have light perception.
Well, then that 1 hour change does, in a way, causes a type of jet lag where you alter your light dark exposure, and then you start to run on a slightly different rhythm to the one you were on before. And although we don't really perceive a big difference, that 1 hour change does cause a huge difference in the amount of sleep we get. And if people have studied, for example, traffic accidents on the Monday after daylight savings time, and the increase in traffic accidents goes sky high on that first Monday after daylight savings time because people's sleep has been reduced by just 1 hour. So if you're on a normal schedule, if you're on a very regular schedule and then you shift it by an hour, it's like flying an hour, it's like going over a whole time zone change. And then you have to readapt to that, which may take a few days to get back in sync with that.
Mm.
So changing your light-dark exposure in any way through flying or through just daylight savings time can have this impact on the body clock and shift the timing of it.
Thanks for your call. Let's take a look at natural things that we can do. I read somewhere once that people can develop a technique for people who wake in the middle of the night, where if they can remember what they were dreaming about, they can try and work themselves back into the dream by focusing on it, as opposed to letting their mind wander about what they're going to do today and all the pressing issues that they should be dealing with. Do you believe that has any merit?
I wouldn't like to comment on whether remembering your dreams is a way of getting back to sleep, but certainly there are many behavioral techniques which people can use to try and help them sleep. And the instance that you're discussing, I think, would really be to relax and to not concentrate on things going through your mind. So many types of behavioral remedies include meditation or breathing deeply or relaxation techniques where you really try and get rid of the thoughts that you have in the day, the things that you're worrying about, the things that you're thinking about for the next day. Really trying a technique to get rid of that. And maybe one way is to try and concentrate on what you were dreaming about. Another way may be to go through breathing exercises. And many of these behavioral techniques recommend having a very regular schedule and keeping the bedroom only for sleep. So not listening to the radio too much, or people watching television, or people reading too much in the bedroom. Really keeping the bedroom only for sleep, having a very strict regime of when you go to bed, having a relaxing type of behavior, sometimes a warm bath or a hot drink or something that relaxes you, takes your mind off what you've been doing that day, and then sort of winds the body down, and breathing exercise is very good at doing that. And then if you do wake up, going through a similar type of pattern to try and, in a way, re-relax yourself and send yourself off to sleep again. Now, these techniques are good if you have a non-body clock type of sleep disorder, but it may be very difficult to force your body to do this if you have a body clock disorder, because as you described at the start of the program, the feeling of tiredness, it's such an overwhelming feeling of tiredness and an overwhelming feeling of being awake in the night if your body clock's out of sync, but it's very difficult to override that, and we don't realize how strong the body clock influence is until it's disordered, and then people report really just uncontrollable tiredness in the daytime, and then being very awake and wide awake and not being able to sleep at all at night. So it's certainly worth trying these behavioral techniques. It's certainly worth trying these relaxation types of behavioral patterns. But people may be disappointed at the time when they're having the most worst sleep, whether they'll work or not.
You would undoubtedly be slapping my hand, because I have a little laptop by the bed that's plugged into our network outlet, and quite often if I can't sleep, I just get up and do mail and surf the web and all kinds of stuff.
Well, it's really up to individuals to decide how they want to cope with being awake. One way is to do exactly that. I mean, the one way is to sort of go with the flow, and if you wake up in the middle of the night, although it's the middle of our night socially, it's not the middle of your night for your body clock. Your body clock thinks that it's morning, I've told you it's time to get up, and then you'll be alert and can work. So some people do that, and I've heard of people I've studied who would just get up and do the ironing at 3 o'clock in the morning because they were wide awake. And that's fine, as long as you can try and find other times to try and catch up on some of that sleep. But often that's difficult to people if they're working full-time or have families to deal with it. It's often difficult to get those naps in the day. But then the other way to try and fight it is to try and fight through it and to try and adopt these techniques to try and get as much sleep as possible at night. But I just don't want to give the impression that that will always work for people with this type of body clock disorder, because they may find it difficult to override that body clock pattern.
For people like me who are fortunate enough now to have an internet-related job, it can be a blessing in disguise, because, you know, in the middle of the night in New Zealand where I am, it's the middle of the day in America, and there's always someone to talk to and business to conduct, so that's very fortunate. On the other side of the coin, though, it's a very difficult thing to explain, particularly to family members who may accuse you of being lazy or trying to shirk your responsibilities, and it's almost comforting to have someone tell you that actually, because you don't have light perception, you have a genuine disorder that's verifiable.
And that's been the wonderful part about some of the research we've done, just being able to tell people exactly that, that there is a real biological reason why they're having this terrible sleep problem where they really can't sleep at night and are very tired in the day. That's been one of the most rewarding things of the work we've been doing, just being able to tell people that this is the real reason for it. And we're trying to educate the medical community as well, because a lot of physicians, they don't get very much training on sleep and sleep medicine in their training. And we need to try and get the message out to people that if a physician treats a totally blind person and they report a sleep disorder, one of the things they should be thinking about is this body clock problem. As I said before, not all sleep disorders are due to this, and not all people without sight will have this disorder, but it should be at least one of the things on the radar for the physician to think about, and we really want to try and get that message out to people. And as you said, I think it is difficult to explain to people. I'm explaining it because I've heard other people's symptoms. I haven't experienced this myself. But the overwhelming desire to sleep in the day, we're told, is huge, and then this real inability to sleep at night. And to go on this sort of continuous jet lag for 40, 50, 60 years, which some people experience, must be terrible. And to anything we can do to even tell people about that or to try and develop treatments is certainly worthwhile, in my opinion.
It's appalling. I can still remember when I was about 14 or 15 in high school and just having this overwhelming urge to sleep in the middle of a history class, and we had the old Perkins Braille machines, which were quite good for sitting at a desk and resting your head on, and the next thing I knew the class was over and the teacher was there whacking a ruler on the desk right next to my ear in an effort to both frighten me and punish me for having gone to sleep in what was undoubtedly an interesting class, I'm sure. But it's a devastating thing. It's debilitating. And the other thing, I guess, it must be very difficult to explain it to is parents of blind children who are affected by this, because often parents don't have any knowledge of blindness before a blind child comes into their life, and they've got a toddler who's two or three running around with life abound in the middle of the night playing with toys and doing all kinds of stuff.
That's right, and that's the part of the message we want to get out as well, is to parents and to teachers to have everybody think that people without light perception, one of the reasons why they might have sleep disorders is because of that body clock disorder. And often I think when children are very young, it's put down to them just being young and the normal problems that the very young children have sleeping. But then as children get older, and even teenagers who have sight, there's this idea that teenagers are lazy and they want to stay in bed till midday every day. And there is a real body clock reason for that happening as well. Our body clocks do change as we age, and they do change from when we're small babies, when the body clock's developing, and that's why babies don't have a very good rhythm for the first few months of life. And then as we go through adolescent years, our body clocks tend to be a bit later and have this owl-type pattern, where teenagers want to go to bed late and get up late. Then as we get older throughout our lives, our body clocks tend to have less influence on sleep, and this is why when we get much older that sleep is much more difficult. And this is not really because of a body clock problem, it's a difference in the amount of sleep you need and the amount of sleep your brain requires. So there are big changes with age, and these may be even more apparent in a child with total blindness, because they would continually have this type of jet lag problem, and just educating families of teachers, schools of this disorder should help, and then hopefully children won't go through the experience that you just described.
Yeah, pretty bad. You made a comment earlier, I've just lost my train of thought. Do you think that we will ever find a cure for this? Is that the ultimate goal?
It's very difficult to say that we'll have a cure that will stop the disorder and stop it for life, because the body clock, your internal body clock, isn't doing anything wrong. It's working perfectly normally. All of our body clocks are set on a day slightly different for 24 hours. So if I go and live in a cave for a few months without light, my body clock will go on a day different from 24 hours. So the body clock internally is working perfectly well. What is lacking is that time cue every day to tell the body clock what time of day it is and to tell it to reset itself. And in the absence of light, then we need to find things which will replace that light signal, will replace that time cue. And we've talked about taking melatonin as a possible time cue. Other time cues are things other than light, and we're investigating whether exercise can reset the body clock, whether keeping a very regular schedule can reset the clock, whether food, in fact, may be able to reset the clock and provide a time signal. And then other compounds, things like caffeine may be able to affect the clock, alcohol may be able to affect the clock. And so there are a variety of different types of time cues which may be able to replace the lack of light. And light is the strongest time cue, so it's difficult to find something which works as well as light. But the work going into melatonin, exercise, and these other non-light time cues may ultimately lead to a way of treating the problem. Whether that is considered a cure is difficult, because the body clock's working well. What is missing is this time cue, which usually goes from the eyes to the brain. And we're trying to replace that. And the problem with all of these treatments is that you have to take it every day. You have to replace the 24-hour pattern of the light and dark. So whatever treatment we come up with, it will be a treatment for life, and it will need to be taken every day, because your body wants that 24-hour time cue.
Interesting. Area code 541 has joined us. Hello there.
Hello, this is Stan from Oregon.
Hi, Stan.
And what I wanted to ask you is that, one, how is there any idea of, or maybe this is a generalization, how long does it take for a person to reset his or her body clock?
Well, if the time cue is working properly, it would take a day or two. The work we've done with melatonin shows that if you do time it properly to people's own body clocks, then you can get an immediate effect, and their body clock will reset to that time within a few days. But it does have to accurately be timed to their own clock. If you get it slightly wrong and don't quite reset the clock by enough, then you may start to drift and have similar types of problems where you're not quite sleeping at the right time and may find you're sleeping at a later and later time. But instead of going through a bad phase over a few weeks, you may find that you're going over a bad phase over a much longer time because you've only sort of partly reset the clock. So one danger is that if you don't get it right in the first place, that you may make the condition worse because you're not fully resetting it. But if it does work, it should work fairly quickly and within a few days.
Now, one of the things that I have personally noticed with melatonin is that sometimes you'll notice the dream state get very, very intense.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it?
What's that?
It's quite amazing, some of the dreams you have on melatonin, actually. Yeah.
Oh, yes, and but the intensity is sort of straight. If it's a bad one, you don't want them really intense.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yes.
There's not been a lot of research done on the effects of melatonin on dreams, but with what melatonin will do is change the type of sleep that you have, and you've probably heard of rapid eye movement sleep.
Yes.
And rapid eye movement sleep is a sleep that we have usually in the second half of the sleep period, and it's associated with dreams, although you do have dreams at other times of the night. So it may be that melatonin is changing the amount of the rapid eye movement sleep you have, and it does change the amount of, it's called non-rapid eye movement or deeper sleep compared to the rapid eye movement sleep. So taking melatonin does change the structure of sleep that you have, and it may be that by doing that, you change this REM sleep, and that may then affect dreams. But how melatonin affects dreams themselves, there's not really a great deal of research.
And, of course, one thing is that it may not be that it's affecting the dreams at all, but maybe that something is forcing you to remember them more.
It may be, and REM sleep, again, is thought to be involved in memory formation. So when you change the sleep structure, when you change the firing, the electrical activity in the brain, which is what we're talking about by sleep structure, then you may improve the memory of the sleep that you had, and REM sleep is involved in memory. So you're not just changing, as I said, we're not just changing the timing of the sleep by taking melatonin, you may be changing the structure, and the knock-on effects of that may be in the sleep itself and in how alert you feel in the daytime.
Now, one other question, which is sort of unrelated, but yet it's related. Now, with people who have sleep apnea, now, are there a great many non-surgical kinds of things that people can do, or is that sleep mask about the only thing?
The sleep mask is certainly the best that has been tested properly. It really does do the job it's supposed to do. It really does keep the airway open, which is why there is a problem with people with sleep apnea, because the airway starts to close up, and that's when you stop breathing.
Now, I wonder if that's a prescription kind of thing.
I'm not sure when it's available. I don't know if it's available on Medicare, for example, or whether it has to be bought. I'm not sure how it's funded. I think it probably varies from physician to physician.
Right.
But other thing that people have tried, and you've probably heard some of the old wives' tales of sewing a tennis ball into the back of people's pajamas or turning over onto one side. I mean, there are these things which I think work. They may work temporarily, because by changing the posture when you sleep, mm-hmm. you reduce the chances of the airway closing completely. The problem is, one of the bigger problems with sleep apnea is that you may be having very small amounts of time where you're not breathing, but are not enough to wake you up completely. So the good thing about the positive airway pressure wearing the mask is that it prevents you having these very short periods of time when you can't breathe properly.
And of course it can be life-threatening.
It can be, and it can cause problems, and there may be other problems. Not just from the sleep apnea itself, but other problems then onto the heart, because you're putting the body under stress when you stop breathing. So the CPAP is a good way of keeping the airway open, and it reduces these mini sort of mini breathing stops, which otherwise you wouldn't notice because you're in sleep at that time.
Well, Well, Jonathan, thank you for taking my call, and I'll move along so someone else can get through.
Always a pleasure. Catch you later. It may be a completely different area, but have you done any work on what whether dreams actually mean anything, why people dream what they dream at a particular time?
No, we haven't done, I'm afraid. And it's a question which always comes up. I should do some research on it because people often ask. There is a lot of work going on into dreams and what they might do. And as I said before, the dreams tend to happen during this rapid eye movement sleep. And in fact, during rapid eye movement sleep, your body becomes paralyzed and the brain sort of cuts itself off from the rest of the body so you don't act out these dreams physically. And so dreams are very important, we think, in memory formation. But we don't really know why we sleep and why we have different types of sleep and why we dream. A lot of the research going on is to really work out why we sleep, what's important about it. We know we have to have it. We know that you have problems if you don't sleep. But really, the function of sleep in the brain, we're really not sure of. So it's a bit too early to say what the function of dreams might be when we don't really know what sleep itself does yet.
With brain scanning technology evolving, do you think there'll ever come a time when people will in fact be able to record their dreams and play them back?
I don't know. It's a very good question. Certainly the types of brain scanning equipment that's available now is being used to study sleep and sleep deprivation. You can see very clear changes in the brain and in different brain areas during sleep. So this technology is starting to be introduced into this field to really see if we can visualize which parts of the brain are active when people are awake and asleep, and then which parts of the brain are active during this rapid eye movement and non-rapid eye movement sleep. So the future's very exciting because using functional techniques where you can look at the brain activity in real time while people are asleep opens a whole world of possibilities to look at sleep and brain function. Whether we can extend that, you know, in the many hundreds of years to extend to dreams, then only time will tell. But it's certainly starting those studies are certainly starting to happen, looking at the brain as it's actually asleep in real life.
Just a reminder that if you'd like to give us a call, we're talking sleep. Area code 212-812-2800 is our number, and the conference code courtesy of Spiderphone is 0480-5512, and you should see this in the title bar of your media player. I'm fairly sure I know who this is. Area code 302, hello.
Yes, Jonathan.
Yes.
It's a subject near and dear to my heart.
Indeed.
I have a question for the doctor about the safety of melatonin. I wonder if he could speak to specifically any adverse effects that have been noted in the studies and dosage limits. What is a safe dose to take? Another concern I have is that in the United States, at least, melatonin is not regulated by any agency. So, you know, I'm just curious as to how one can verify the quality of the particular substance that they're taking. I mean, I've seen melatonin sold in gift shops, and I ask myself, you know, are these sugar pills?
No, that's a very, very good question. Melatonin is a natural hormone. It is a hormone, so it isn't taken like a supplement. It shouldn't be taken like a supplement or a vitamin. It really is a hormone, so it shouldn't be taken lightly. It's certainly true that you need to make sure you have a pure dose of melatonin, and there have been cases in the past where people have had problems from taking drugs which they thought were melatonin but had not been converted properly into melatonin. So people have to be very careful about finding a pure dose. And we'll be able to provide at the end of the show a source for pure melatonin, which is certainly able to supply melatonin in the UK, and they might have agents which can supply it over on this side of the Atlantic. The safety, long-term safety of melatonin has never been tested. And the main reason for this is that because it's a natural hormone, pharmaceutical companies can't patent it, so they're unwilling to invest the millions and millions of dollars required to do a full long-term safety check for melatonin in humans. The sort of anecdotal tests, the research that's gone on but have not been through the strict requirements for drug tests, show that it's not a very toxic substance. People can take it to quite high doses, and animal studies have shown that in very high doses it doesn't kill animals, which is a good thing to start with. But it is a pharmacological dose. It is a dose which is many, many times higher than you would naturally produce, and we don't know what the long-term effects of that are. As far as dosing for curing the sort of non-24-hour sleep-wake disorders, several studies have come out showing that there doesn't really seem to be any difference between a 0.5 milligram dose and a 10 milligram dose. So people have shown, we've shown, and then the group in Oregon, Drs. Louie and Sack, have been able to show that a 0.5 milligram dose of melatonin is able to reset your clock, and also a 5 milligram dose has been shown to work, and a 10 milligram dose has been shown to work. Whether they work below 0.5 milligrams, we're still trying to work on, and we're doing those studies at the moment. But even a 0.5 milligram dose is still many times higher than you would naturally produce. So really melatonin should be taken only from a pure source once that can be obtained, and it should really only be taken under the guidance of a physician. And the physician can prescribe melatonin and can ensure you get a pure supply of it, and then would also probably be able to help us make the test to make sure that people are taking it at the right time. But it certainly isn't a pill that should be taken without any thought, and I certainly wouldn't recommend children taking it, people under the age of 18, and people with previous psychiatric disorders, or people who are pregnant. So there are some, I think there are some risks of melatonin in certain certain types of people. Really, like any drug, it should be taken under the supervision of a physician.
Yes, I saw an article not long ago where they were claiming that blind individuals have lower rates of cancer, and they were attributing that to the higher production of melatonin. And I've done some research, and I've found some things about melatonin's effect on the immune system, and I was just curious to know what effects melatonin does have on the immune system. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you. Well, there have been very many claims made for melatonin, and it's been talked about as a miracle drug and having all sorts of effects in humans. Some of the effects that have been claimed for melatonin include helping your immune system, curing cancer, helping you live longer, improving your sex life. Virtually everything that you can think of has been attributed to being improved by melatonin. And the reason for that is a set of research which did show some effects of melatonin in animals, but can't be transferred to humans. And melatonin, like many other substances, has some antioxidant effects. It can help reduce the free radical oxygen molecules in your body, which tend to harm cells. But none of the studies that have been done in animals have been transferred to humans to show that it can have these effects in humans, for example, helping with cancer. Now, the hypothesis that melatonin, or having higher rates of melatonin in blind people, means a lower incidence of cancer is on shaky ground. We did the largest study of melatonin levels in blind people ever done, and we found that the levels of melatonin in blind people were no different to those in sighted population. So there isn't good evidence that, in fact, blind people do have more melatonin than sighted people. And then to link that to lower rates of cancer is a big stretch to be able to make that connection. There is other anecdotal evidence which people might have heard of, that, for example, people with shift work disorder, so air stewardesses, may have a higher incidence of breast cancer because they're continually changing shifts. And many of these types of stories come about from anecdotal evidence, but there have been very few properly controlled studies to try and assess this. So it's really too early to say whether the amount of melatonin that you have, or even the timing of the melatonin, is related, for example, to cancer or to changes in the immune system. So really, those studies need to be done in a controlled way before we can make those types of statements.
And then when you go looking for melatonin, you see that there are all sorts of melatonin variants, such as timed-release melatonin, which is supposed to secrete it into your bloodstream overnight to keep you asleep longer and more steadily. Some people say the melatonin taken as a sublingual tablet works more efficiently. Any comments on that?
They're all very interesting types of formulations, and we would like to do more research into different types of formulation for melatonin. And something we would like to do in the future is to do some of those studies here to try and find out whether a particular type of release works better than others. There's been no research at all into controlled release substances, controlled release melatonin to help sleep in blind people. The only doses that have been used are the oral doses, the fast release doses that are usually in a gelatin lactose capsule that get released very quickly into the bloodstream, and then have a huge amount of melatonin initially, which gradually tapers off. they're the only ones that have been properly tested in a placebo-controlled condition. So although all of these other types are available on the market for blind people, they've never been tested. And as explained before, the difficulty in using it for jet lag and shift work disorder, where this type of natural profile, this time release, may be effective, is that they haven't, again, been done under controlled conditions. And if you take it at the wrong time of day, it could have the opposite effect. So, in a way, people taking melatonin are undergoing an uncontrolled mass experiment into the effects of what can be quite a powerful drug without any controls. And we really do need to do properly controlled, funded studies of melatonin's effects to really make sure we know how it works and then what the possible good and bad effects of it are.
We've talked a lot about melatonin. What about conventional sleeping medications that a general practitioner might prescribe? Are they an option for dealing with blind people who don't have light perception?
They may be used to treat a sleep disorder, but they wouldn't necessarily be that good at treating this body clock disorder. As I said before, there are many, many reasons why people have sleep disorders, and often types of sleeping medications are prescribed not only for their effects on sleep, but they also have a mild antidepressant effect as well. So the types of sleeping pills that people get might be absolutely the right thing to take for their type of sleep disorder once the physician has assessed that. But if they have this non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, this free-running body clock, then we wouldn't recommend taking a sleeping pill, because all the sleeping pill would do is mask the problem. It doesn't treat the underlying cause, which is that the body clock doesn't have a time cue to latch onto. And all that the sleeping pill will do is sort of mask you and mask the sleep and drug the sleep so you sleep better temporarily. But that effect may wear off after a few days or weeks. And the underlying body clock is still running on its own time. And really the only way to treat this body clock disorder is to reset the body clock. And these drugs, these sleeping pills, haven't been shown to do that in humans.
We have another call on the line, so we'll go to that now. Hello there. Hello. You're on.
Hello,
the...
my name is Michael from Germany.
Michael, you're up in the middle of the night.
That's right. I can't sleep.
Go ahead.
All right. My name is Michael, and I have a question for Steve.
Yep.
You talked about the exact time when one should take melatonin. I missed the first 10 minutes of the program, so I don't know whether you've talked about that in more detail then, but could you tell exactly when one should take the melatonin?
This really, it's a $6 million question, and unfortunately, the answer is different for everybody, for each different person, because it isn't that it's a best time according to clock time that's the best time to take melatonin. It's a best time according to your internal body clock.
Mm-hmm.
And unless I know the timing of your internal body clock, I can't say what that time is. One thing we did discuss earlier was to try and guess when that time might be. And if people have that free-running body clock where they go through good phases and bad phases of sleep, the approximate time to start taking melatonin would be as they're slipping into a bad phase, so as they're going from a good phase and starting to go into a bad phase, and then to take melatonin at around 9 or 10 o'clock. So at that time, the idea is that the melatonin pill gives a time cue to the body clock to sort of grab onto the sleep and to pull it back by a few hours, so to pull it back into a good phase. So the sort of symptoms that people would have if they were just slipping into that bad phase would be difficulty going to sleep in the early night, so maybe not being able to get to sleep till 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and then difficulty waking up in the morning and wanting to stay in bed till maybe 8, 9, 10, 11 in the morning. And so that type of time would be the time to start taking melatonin and take it at around 9 or 10 p.m.
I see. And to get more precise, one would have to try out different times.
Well, the one way would be to try different times, or we discussed earlier keeping a sleep log or keeping a sleep diary to try and work out the exact length of your own personal cycle. To try and work out how long it takes, and then we can try and predict when would be the best time to take it. And then the more detailed measure would be to take some urine samples over a 24-hour period once a week for maybe 4 or 5 weeks, and then from the hormones that we assay in the urine, such as melatonin or cortisol, which are hormones we can measure, we can work out exactly the timing of your body clock and then work out much more precisely the best time to take it. And the it really is as simple as collecting urine samples and just having them measured, and then over a 4, 5, 6 week period, you can see how quickly the body clock changes, and you can work out much more accurately when the time is to take it. So that really needs the involvement of a physician, but it's not an expensive thing to do. It's not a difficult thing to collect samples, and after sort of a 2 month period, you would have the results back, and you'd be able to predict much better when to start taking the melatonin.
Wow, that's a great idea. Well, I think I have a circadian rhythm problem, and there are some people who always try to tell me to go to a sleep laboratory.
Right.
Would you think that this is a good idea?
The sleep laboratory would certainly be able to assess whether you had a circadian disorder, but they wouldn't be able to do it just in a single night. Often people go to a sleep laboratory if they have sleep disorders and are assessed for 1 or 2 nights there. You would have to go to a sleep clinic that, of course, knew about circadian sleep disorders, and I'm sure they would, and then they would assess you over a period of weeks to really look at the timing of the rhythm. You don't necessarily have to go to a sleep clinic to get that assessment, because really the best measure we've found is to look at the hormones in urine samples rather than to make a formal assessment of your sleep where we put electrodes on your head and look at the brain activity during sleep. So although a clinic would hopefully be able to provide the facility for you to provide the urine samples and to assess them, you don't really need to go and have a formal assessment of brain activity to work out whether you have this sleep disorder or not.
Okay, that were great answers, especially this urine sample test thing. I'll try to find somebody which can do that for me, and thank you.
If you or anyone listening wants to know how we would do that, then please get in touch with us, and we can send people instructions about how to take part in that, about how to assess the urine samples properly, and then we can possibly recommend a place to send them to or involve you in some of the studies that we're doing in the laboratory and do that as part of the laboratory assessments to work out if you have this type of problem.
Oh, fine. Okay, thank you.
All the very best with it, Michael. I hope you make some progress. It's a dreadful thing to be burdened with. Yeah, thank you for giving us a call.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Good luck to you too, Jonathan.
Thanks, I'm a lot better than I used to be. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You mentioned alcohol earlier, and in fact a number of other contributing factors that may or may not help. Is there any advice generally with respect to sleep? What effect is alcohol thought to have if you have, for example, a few glasses of wine with your meal or something like that?
Well, alcohol does disturb sleep. We talked before about rapid eye movement sleep and non-rapid eye movement sleep. And what alcohol tends to do is reduce the amount of deep sleep that you have. So even though you think you sleep well because you hit the pillow and then you don't wake up until many hours later, the quality of sleep you're having, the type of sleep you're having, has changed when you drink. And then that's why you feel tired the next day, because even though you think you've been asleep for a long period of time, the type of sleep you've had has varied. So alcohol as a treatment for sleep disorders is not good. People often use alcohol to help them go to sleep if they're having sleep disorders. And although that might help them sleep initially, the type of sleep they're having is generally much worse, and it really isn't a long-term solution to sleep disorders. Having said that, a very small amount of alcohol is part of this type of relaxation process that we talked about earlier, where you go through a series of behaviors to try and wind down for the day and try and relax. Then a small amount of alcohol, you know, a hot toddy, a small tot of whiskey in with some milk or with water, a very small amount may help you with that relaxing process and then help you send yourself to sleep. But as a treatment to try and send yourself to sleep in large amounts or type of sleep you have after alcohol, generally they're not good.
Are you about to conduct a new series of research exercises? Is that what's happening, or is what you're doing at present sort of an ongoing study looking into this issue?
We're trying to start a new series of studies. There have been several laboratories in the world who have been doing this type of research. The laboratory I came from in England at the University of Surrey in Guildford started doing some of this research in the mid-80s, and were in fact the first laboratory to give melatonin to a blind man and to help him sleep. And then, as I mentioned before, there's a laboratory in Portland, Oregon, that have also done a great deal of research from the mid-80s into this problem. And then 5 or 6 years ago, Harvard Medical School and the Brigham Women's Hospital, one of your callers mentioned earlier, he'd done a study there previously, also started to look into this field. So all of these laboratories are still active in this area. And what we're trying to do at the moment is to restart some of the studies at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and it's to really bring together the research I did in England previously with the work that they're doing and did here at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, so that to bring the work of those two laboratories together. And we have a series of studies. The one we're currently asking people to take part in involves spending some time at home making some measurements to really establish that you have this type of sleep disorder, and then coming to live in the laboratory in Boston for 5.5 weeks. And we would have you come and live in our laboratory, and we would do a series of studies while you're in the laboratory, and you would live there for that whole time. And then we'd compare the type of sleep disorders you have at home compared to the types of studies we were doing in the laboratory. So that's the study we're looking for volunteers for at the moment. And then in the future, we hope to look in more detail at the studies involving melatonin. And that extends the work that we started in England. In fact, we were the first group to show that melatonin could reset the body clock in blind people. And we'd like to readdress that and start to look at different doses of melatonin, as one of your callers mentioned, and also different preparations of melatonin, as you mentioned, to try and see whether there's a particular dose which is better than others, or to see whether different preparations of melatonin work better. So we're gearing up to start the laboratory and home study now, and then we hope to start the home studies of melatonin over the next few months.
So you are, in fact, seeking volunteers right now?
We are, yes. We want to study anyone without light perception, whether you have a sleep disorder or not. We're interested in studying why people have sleep disorders and what type of blindness that's related to, then how we overcome that. And we're also interested in those people who have no light perception but don't have any sleep disorders, because we want to know why they're able to cope with the lack of light perception, why they don't have sleep disorders. So really, anyone without light perception, whether you have had your eyes removed or not, we're interested in studying anyone at all without light perception.
Hmm. And does the university pay for those people to get to the laboratory or that kind of thing?
Absolutely. All the expenses are paid for. We can study people from really anywhere in the world. We would fly them to Boston to take part in the laboratory part. We would do some studies at home, first of all, where we would ask you to keep a sleep diary, as we discussed earlier on, and to wear a small watch-like device which measures your rest activity cycle and your light exposure. We'd ask you to collect some urine samples at home so we can measure the hormones in the urine, as I mentioned before. It is a very good way of tracking your body clock. And then we'd ask you to come to Boston, and we'd fly to Boston for 5.5 weeks. You'd live in our laboratories in the hospital in Boston, and there are many, many people there, so you'd get to meet our team of technicians and all the doctors there. And then we'd study the very similar things that you did at home, but we'd look at you in the laboratory. So we'd look at your sleep there, we'd collect urine samples, we'd collect some blood samples to measure hormones with, and then we'd look at differences between your sleep and body clock in the laboratory versus the measurements we took at your home.
Well, it sounds like an offer that many couldn't refuse, I'm sure. So, and...
Well, people can consider it it's not quite a vacation, but it would be time for people to spend with them for themselves. They would be able to bring projects. We'd provide whatever facilities people needed. The only thing that people should know, when you're living in a laboratory, then you wouldn't have access to any time cues, because we want to look at your body clock in its natural state without the influence of any time cues. So, unfortunately, anything that has a live time component, you wouldn't be allowed to have at that time, so live radio or live internet access. But of course, we would be able to take programs for people. We would be able to provide people with anything they needed after it had happened, but you just wouldn't have access to time cues.
How amazing. So you would not, for 5 weeks, you would not know what the time is.
That's right. And we do very similar studies to this in sighted people, and we have people who come to the laboratory for over 2 months. We have people who come for two and a half months, who live in the laboratory for that time and don't get access to time cues, and just go with the flow and just enjoy not being in a way chained to that clock or chained to time, just doing what you want to do naturally and seeing what time your body clock has when it's under those conditions.
Gosh, that's a hard concept, isn't it? I just couldn't imagine not being able to check a clock for, you know, even a couple of hours, let alone 5 weeks. It's
Well, it may be liberating.
Often it may be.
Often describe it as being a liberating response because you're no longer tied to that artificial time, and of course that time is artificial. We invent it for ourselves, and we would live on a much different type of day if we kept in tune with our natural body clock, because we would naturally rise with the sun and go to sleep when it goes dark, if you had light perception. And then, so that concept of being tied to a watch or a clock or artificial time, that people find it enjoyable not to have to worry about the time. And of course, the other things you don't have to worry about are making meals or spending any money or doing any of the other things, because of course we look after you and make sure everything's done for you while you're here. So it's quite a liberating experience for some people.
That's fascinating. And so you hope to have a lot more information at the end of this process. That how will that be put to use, that information?
Well, we still need to extend the knowledge of why some people have sleep disorders and why some people don't. So as I mentioned before, there are these people, there's about a quarter of people with total sight loss who don't have any sleep problems, who sleep perfectly well. And we want to know what's keeping their body clock on a normal time of day. Is it that they have this subconscious light perception that's going through the eyes but they can't see it? Is it that they're kept in check by social cues? Is it that they have other things that keep their body clock in check? So we need to try and work out what things in the environment can replace light, then use that as a possible therapy in the future. And then we want to look at the timing of people's body clocks, because there's a very big range in the timing of people's clocks, and we don't know why one person has a body clock that's, for example, 23.9 hours and another person has 24.5 hours. So we need to look at the difference between those different types of rhythms and then to see whether the treatment of those people depends on their body clock. So is it easier to treat someone with a rhythm that's close to 24 hours than someone with a rhythm that's close to 25 hours? And if we want to develop therapies that can be used for everybody, we really need to know how, for example, melatonin treatment or how these other non-light time cues affect everybody. And that's a whole range of people, from those with and without sleep disorders and then those with the more extreme types of body clocks compared to those that have a clock very close to 24. So the numbers of blind people studied for their body clock disorders only goes into the hundreds. I mean, it's probably only around 150 or so have ever been studied. And then to try and form treatments on just a study of 150 people is clearly difficult, because you need to study many more people to make sure it's applicable to the whole population. So we're trying to extend the research we've done so far, then also try new avenues, so looking at these other things like exercise, like light, like different doses of melatonin, see if we can really optimize treatments to cure this sleep disorder.
So how many subjects are you looking for this particular experiment?
As many as possible. Of course, the more people we can get, the better. We would like to study 25 people in our experiment, where people come and live in the lab for 5.5 weeks. But if we get more people than that, then we'd study more people than that. We really would like to study as many people as possible. And then when we develop and finalize the study to look at the effects of melatonin, which we hope to do towards the end of the summer, then we would hope that would be, you know, dozens or even more, maybe hundreds of people who would be involved in the melatonin study, to really try and work out the best dose and the best type of melatonin to give to people.
So in the complete absence of time cues, you wouldn't actually know how long you'd been there until it was over, right?
That's right. We would tell you at the end. And often when we've had people studied for a very long time, they get it completely wrong and they think they've still got 2 weeks to go and it's actually time to leave. But often people don't worry about it, because they're liberated from this idea of time, this artificial time to stick to. And they just enjoy going with the flow and not worrying about time. But it's people try and keep track, but they find it very difficult over many, many days to keep up with the time without getting time cues. And I don't want to give people the impression that you would be in isolation. It's not that it's an isolation study. We would have people coming in and out of the room very often. You would have access to things like newspapers or radio programs, but it would be several days after it actually happened, so you wouldn't be able to use that information as a time cue. So it's not that people are in any isolation. You have a lot of contact with the outside world. It's just delayed. And as far as contact with people, there are many, many people working at the hospital that would be in and out of the suite regularly. So You'd get to meet many people. You'd have some time to do your own projects and to bring any projects you wanted to bring. And then we'd provide information to you that you needed in terms of newspapers or tapes or other bits of information. But it would just be delayed, so it wouldn't be a time key for you.
How interesting. What about phoning home or having home phone you?
Well, again, the trouble with that is that it's a live time queue. So we wouldn't have any live telephone calls, but it would be possible for people to send in tapes, for example, for you to listen to, or for you to send out tapes for people to listen to. So there would be communication, and people could receive letters or send out letters. We can send email on your behalf. You can receive email if we delay it. So people can communicate, but it would just be in the more old-fashioned way of some, you know, delayed correspondence over several days rather than the instant communications that we're used to in the 21st century.
And people will be sleeping with monitoring equipment attached, such as electrodes, that kind of thing?
That's right, yes. We would be measuring people's brain activity while they slept, and we have a small number of electrodes which we place over different parts of the head to look at your brain waves. And that's something that's not been done very often in blind people, looking at how their sleep changes as they go through this body clock problem. We know that they have trouble sleeping, but we don't know very much about the changes in brain activity. So you would be able to sleep with these electrodes, but after a day or two of getting used to them, then people don't really have a problem sleeping with them.
Right, so it's not uncomfortable then?
No, I mean, it's like anything. You take a while to get used to it. The first night or second night that you have them, you're aware that they're there, but then after a few nights, you get used to them, and they shouldn't disturb your sleep at all after a couple of days.
Hmm. All right. Is there a resource, a web page that people can go to find out about particularly the issue, well, sleep disorders in general, I guess, but in particular the question of totally blind people without light perception and the issues that they have?
Unfortunately, there isn't. As much as I would like to have done this, we haven't yet developed it. We are trying to develop a web page attached to the Harvard Medical School Division of Sleep Medicine, and we haven't yet established that. So unfortunately, there isn't a resource. The best thing I can offer at the moment is that if people write to you or to me, then I can offer a sort of fact sheet or a type of information sheet which gives some of the basic things we've covered tonight. And then if people want more information after that, then there are very many publications available and much more detailed information, much more scientific detailed information. But I'm happy to send people a sort of a fact sheet of types of things we've talked about tonight, and then maybe some of the resources they can use to find more information for themselves.
That would be marvellous, because often when you go to a physician for the first time, they really, as you say, often haven't had a lot of experience with this subject, and so to have a piece of paper that you can hand over and say, look, this is just to help you build up a picture of me and some of the medical issues I face, that would be incredibly useful.
And I'm happy, in addition to that, if people are going to their GP, I'm happy to write to their primary care physician. It's called a GP in England.
Yeah, and here.
I'm happy for people to write to me, and I can provide the scientific literature that the primary care physician can read. There have been many publications, including publications in the New England Journal of Medicine and some sleep journals, which we can send to the doctor before you go and see them. So I'm happy to send information to physicians to tell them that this is a real biological disorder even before people go. So if people want more information, then they can write to me and I can send that out.
Well, if you're agreeable, what we can do is when we put this archive up on the website, we can also provide a link to your email address. Are you comfortable with that?
Yep, that'd be fine. We can. That'd be great if you could put the fact sheet up as a web page, then people can have access to that easily.
Yeah, we can do that too. I mean, we'd like to do anything that we can do to help. If people want to get in touch before we put that archive up, how do people do that?
Yeah, the best way is either to telephone or to email, if I can give you those numbers now.
Sure.
The telephone number is Boston. It's 617-732-4977. And if people call me, I'll call them straight back, so they shouldn't worry about any long-distance charges. And then the email address to write to me at is slockley, which is slockley, at hms.harvard.edu.
Okay, I've just written down the email address there, and so that's slockley at hms.harvard.edu.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's a fascinating area. It's obviously something. What can I ask you? What got you interested in this? Why did you decide to specialize in the whole area of sleep disorders?
Well, it originally started looking at body clock disorders in humans. I was interested in doing human research when I was looking for a PhD project, and in my first degree we'd done some classes where we were talking about body clock disorders and talking about how the body clock worked, and then a PhD position became available in the University of Surrey in England, and I was lucky enough to get that position. And the study was really to establish a database of sleep disorders in blind people, to really try and take that forward. And we, with the Moorfields Eye Hospital in London, we managed to do a survey of visually impaired people to show that the majority of people with no light perception, around two-thirds, had a sleep disorder, and even half of people with any type of visual impairment had a sleep disorder. And that was the first step to then establishing the database and doing the more detailed studies of people's problems. And we studied over 100 people in one way or another over a sort of 5 or 6 year period, and that work is continuing now at the University of Surrey in England under the supervision of Dr. Deborah Skeen, who was my supervisor there. And then I've since come to the Brigham Women's Hospital in Harvard, and we've tried to extend the research that they were doing on blind people there, and really try and push the field forward. So it's just a fascinating field. The most rewarding aspect has been trying to treat people and giving melatonin to some of the blind people who've had problems, and then listening to the stories when it's worked. It doesn't always work. It's not it's not a panacea. It doesn't cure all ills, but it certainly can work in some people. And as we've heard about tonight, it can be such a debilitating problem that anything we can do to improve that is certainly worthwhile.
Yes, and I don't want to sound like a salesman, because I'm not, but I couldn't begin to explain how melatonin has changed my life in terms of my ability to be functional and productive, and of course easier to live with, you know, because if you're not sleeping correctly, you're like a bear with a sore head, and it's just made such a difference.
That's great to hear, and it's you've obviously been lucky enough to take it at a time where it has a good effect. I would just reiterate that not everyone will have that experience, and it does need to be accurately timed to really optimize its effects. So it's, I wouldn't want everyone listening to the program to suddenly go out and start taking melatonin.
Absolutely.
Without seeing a physician and without trying to assess their body clock first. But I'm certainly pleased that you found it works for you.
Yeah, after quite a bit of hit and miss, I should add too, I've been working on this for about 10 or 11 years.
Exactly. So we might be able to speed that process up if we do some assessments beforehand.
You mentioned earlier in the show that you would mention a source of reliable melatonin, for want of a better word.
Yes, and in the fact sheet, I'll put that address up. There is a company in the UK, in Tredegar in Wales, called Penn Pharmaceuticals, who we use as our source for our experimental melatonin. So that would be the source in the UK. I'd have to check the source that we have for that Harvard Medical School uses, and whether I can post that information on the website. But there certainly is a pure source available from Penn Pharmaceuticals. And if people go through a primary care physician, then the physician can have the pharmacy find a pure source of melatonin. And that would be a much better way of getting melatonin than buying it over the counter, where often it's packed with other things. It's packed with vitamins, for example. You don't know the exact dose in some preparations. So I would always recommend that people have it on prescription from a physician, and then have the pharmacy ensure that you have a pure source of the melatonin.
I've also read that synthetically produced melatonin is supposed to be a lot safer than animal extract melatonin, especially in these days of BSE and all sorts of other disease.
Yeah. That's absolutely right, but there is no available animal extract melatonin. The first experiments done on melatonin over 50 years ago now were certainly done on extracted pineal glands from cows originally. But all of the melatonin produced today, as far as I know, is synthetically manufactured. So it isn't. People shouldn't worry about, for example, getting mad cow disease from melatonin, because it should be produced by a company as a synthetic hormone. Although there are some risks associated with that. If the process is not properly controlled, then the tryptophan, which is the precursor of melatonin, it's a dietary amino acid, if that is not fully converted, there can be some problems with taking too much of the tryptophan. So people should really make sure they do have a pure source, and the best way to do that is through a physician who can then have the pharmacy ensure the quality of the product.
Steve, I'd like to thank you so much for staying a little over time as well, and for explaining everything so clearly. It's been an interesting show, and I hope that some people will find 5 weeks to help you in what is just such important work, and I hope you get some people getting in touch as a result of the show tonight.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. If people have got questions, they should feel very free to contact me, either by email or telephone. And then if you get a lot of feedback, then I'd appreciate it if you pass that on, and maybe I could come back one day and talk a bit more about the research we've done.
Any time. Be most fascinated, and do keep us informed, and I hope we'll speak again.
Great.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye now. And that's Dr. Stephen Lockley, who's talking to us from Harvard about his research into sleep disorders, and in particular those disorders which affect blind people without light perception. Interesting, isn't it? Now, who's going to volunteer, eh? Who's going to volunteer to go into the lab for 5 weeks and not know what the time is and have electrodes on your head and be pampered? I mean, this is a trip to Massachusetts here. That's where Harvard is, isn't it? Yeah, I think. and that sounds amazing. I could be quite tempted. I wonder if Chris will give me 5 weeks off. You listening, Mr. Gray? I'd like 5 weeks off so I can go and spend some time in a lab in Massachusetts. What a nice thought. Eh? I couldn't even produce main menu from in there because my PC would have a clock. What a wonderful idea. Well, the lines are free now. We are going to go into an open forum, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, it's area code 212-812-2800. That's the number to call. Area code 212-812-2800. And when you're asked to enter a conference code, courtesy of spiderphone.com, it's 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. I'm talking now while I have the opportunity because I'm going to the dentist's dentist straight after the program. I've got incredible toothache, so if I sound a bit different today, that's why. All right, if you've got anything on your mind, you're most welcome to give us a call. Would you like to continue talking about your experiences with sleep or lack thereof? I was really interested by how many people commented on the friends list, the ACB Radio friends list, that they had difficulties with their sleep, and that it's been an issue for a very long time, and you see it. It's fascinating. If you have a look at email lists that blind people are on, and you look at the time they're posting, if you take the time to do that, it's amazing how many people are posting at 3-4 in the morning. It's an issue. And it's fantastic that people like Stephen Lockley, who just explain things so clearly, are on the case, and we should do all we can to assist him to get the data he needs to make a difference. Experience with melatonin. Maybe you have some comments to share with people on that. If you've used melatonin, has it worked for you? Has it not? Did you have a bit of a play in terms of when you took it and the type that you took? And did you finally arrive on a timing regime that did the job for you? You can, at least this is my personal experience, and I can only speak not as obviously anyone with a medical qualification in this area, but you can overdose and get a bit groggy in the morning if you have too much melatonin. That's been my experience, and I certainly found that 5 milligrams was too much and went to 2.5, and that seems to do the job for me personally, but as they say, your mileage may vary. Let's go back to the phones. Hello, this is Blind Line.
Hello.
Hi.
I just called to, you know, tell you what a great show you're having today.
Oh, thanks.
I guess tonight would be tonight where I'm from.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said I just called to tell you what a great show you're having tonight.
Well, thank you very much. He's a very interesting guest, and I hope we can talk to him again sometime.
Yeah. Do they archive these shows? Or?
They do. It should be up by in the next couple of days, that'll be up in the archives, and we'll also see if we can get some information from Steve to put there to accompany the show, and we'll make sure we hyperlink his email address so that people can get in touch if they wish to.
Yeah, okay, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, I thought so.
I just thought, you know, to tell you what a good show you're having, and I'm glad you got the ACB tuner out, and...
Darren's done a wonderful job with that. It's just so much more responsive now with this new version that he's done, and by and large it's working well, except for earlier versions of Winamp, but it's he's done a fine job with it.
Okay, so it'll work with the version Winamp 7.9?
2.79 will work fine. I think the magic number is 2.77. It seems to be 2.77 and higher appear to work fine. Once you get down to 2.76, we appear to be having some issues there. It may be that there have been some changes to the way Winamp calls file names or something like that, but if you have the latest, that should work fine.
Is there a big difference between the 7.8 and the 7.9?
Not to my knowledge. They've introduced a new Waveout plugin and made a few changes, but to the average person, I couldn't say that I've noticed any significant differences. Although I did think as I was playing it over my studio monitors the other day that 2.79 sounds a bit cleaner, but that may be my imagination.
Okay, and as far as the full and the standard, is there a big difference between that?
Say again?
I always download. Between the full and the standard, is there...
The full, I think, has a few additional Winamp skins and things. I don't believe, and possibly the Windows Media support's only in the full. We generally make the standard available on ACB Radio because it seems to suffice for most people.
Oh, okay. I always get the full because, you know, I guess more is better, you know, so...
Yeah. Well, see how you go with the... With the standard, I think that should do the job for you.
Okay. Okay, well, I just wanted to, you know, congratulate you on a pretty good show, and I'll call back some other time.
It's very kind of you. Thank you for phoning in.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. I'm reminded, we were talking just before the end of our interview segment about BSE and mad cow disease, all of those sorts of things, and I was reminded of the story of the two cows who were sitting in the field one day, and one cow said to the other cow, "Gosh, it's terrible about that mad cow disease, isn't it? I hope I never get that mad cow disease. It sounds terrible." And the other cow says, "Yes, it does sound terrible, but there's no way that I'd ever get it." And the first cow said, "Why is that?" The second cow said, "Because I'm a helicopter." Yeah, hi, this is Blind Line.
Good heavens.
Hi there.
Hi, Jonathan.
How are you?
Pretty good.
You're looking well.
I wanted to say a couple. Say again?
You're looking well.
Oh, thank you. So are you.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, I just wanted to comment. I was taking melatonin for a while, and I noticed one of the first things that I did notice was that in the beginning, the day would seem just very much longer. Not very much, but I would take it at night, and I'd say, "It's only 10 o'clock, or it's only whatever." It seemed to alter my sense of time. Now, as far as jet lag, or, well, daylight saving time, or time change, I should say, after the first day, it doesn't exist anymore. I have very little sense of time. I always have.
Hmm. It's funny how... And do you have light perception?
Tiny, tiny, tiny bit, and it is... It's fading. I mean, it's been going steadily.
Because
I have cataracts that are covering things up, that are obscuring the lens, and my eyes are so sensitive to glare that I've been advised by a couple of doctors not to even try to remove them because I probably would have trouble leaving the house.
Mm. There are certainly it seems to me a disproportionate number of people who have sleep issues even when they do have some light perception, and I don't know whether that's just the way it goes with the population, and I should have checked that out, you know, how many, what percentage of the population in general is said to have some sort of sleeping disorder, irregularity. So it's hard to know what's blindness related and what isn't sometimes.
It is. Well, I also wanted to tell you that our friend Tina is really excited, very excited about the Freedom Box.
Well, we've
already got friends planning to send her email. I mean, she's going to enjoy it.
We're excited about giving it to somebody who's not online yet. You know, that just went so well that, you know, the other day that when we gave it away, I was delighted.
It really went, it did. And the interesting thing was that we first approached her boyfriend about it. And he was kind of iffy, and he had some questions and what have you. So when I found out that there actually was a local phone number, I called him up to tell him. He was he wasn't able to talk right then. So we called Tina's house, and we started telling her just how, you know, what a great thing it would be, and how Mike, we had found more information, and so forth and so forth, and that Mike really would like it. And she said, I want it! So, and then Dave said, you know, the two of us kind of, you know, this really is more of a system than Tina would enjoy, because Mike has a specific purpose, and it's doable. It's certainly doable, because we did each download the trial version, but Tina has really never had any experience with the web, and she is going to have a ball. And, of course, the two of them are going to be, you know, work. He won't be able to keep his hands off it. I know him. So,
well,
they will have, you know, they'll have a lot of fun. And she you know, she's really excited. Can I send email? Can I this? Can I do that? And I told her about ACB Radio and some of the other stations. So as soon as she gets it, she'll give us a call, and we'll go on over there to her home. And we'll give her a little lesson, which she'll should get very, very quickly. And Mike will get it very quickly as well. So between the three of us, she should be up and telecommunicating very easily and very quickly.
That's really, really great. And I was demonstrating it to somebody who hadn't used a computer before, and within about 35 minutes they were up and running on it, getting all sorts of information out of it. The learning curve is just so minor, and that's the significant thing about it, I think.
It is. I think now, interestingly enough, we had a couple of issues setting up the software, the trial software, that she's not going to have to deal with.
Hmm.
I mean, I had to do a little bit of fighting with Zone Alarm and et cetera, et cetera.
I don't know why people bother with that thing. It seems to, everywhere I turn, it seems to be more trouble than it's worth.
Well, I guess I'm paranoid about my access and my safety, because we both tend to keep online. We'll spend 20 odd hours just listening to audio streams.
Oh, good on you.
So,
all ACB Radio, I hope.
Excuse me?
All ACB Radio audio streams.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Of course.
You know, but you could always go with Tiny Personal Firewall or something.
I've heard about that.
Yeah.
That's gotten pretty good reviews.
It has. Dave Worldwide Williams did a very positive review of it on Main Menu a while ago.
I have to look that up. Plus which, we also have we're running Black Ice Defender as well. I mean, I can't be happy with one firewall. I gotta have two.
Man, don't they conflict with one another?
Actually, they don't seem to, which is interesting. Those two haven't. In fact, some friends of mine in the local computer user group have done the same thing. And they've had no problems.
Okay. We need to get somebody to do a review of Zone Alarm and a sort of a tutorial for Main Menu, because we haven't looked at that program on Main Menu.
Of course, like Dave said, we're several versions behind. So we, in fact, I was thinking yesterday when I was getting knocked out and I couldn't get through a problem. I thought I was trying to get End It All to shut down. That's what I'd also like to see, is a tutorial on End It All. The new End It All is much more comprehensive than the previous one. But I thought I was going to have to try and disable part of Zone Alarm.
I'm boring. I like the old End It All. I like it. I like the simple fact that you could just check what you wanted to keep in there and just click End It All and boom, it was gone.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot easier.
It was. Nothing's as simple as it used to be, you know, Pam.
Sure isn't.
The world has become
more
complicated.
Let somebody else on here.
All right, then. Well, have a lovely night, and we're looking forward to getting the Freedom Box to Tina and the software to Dave as well.
Great. We will be gone. I doubt it'll come this quickly anyway, but we will be gone through this Thursday night. We're on our way to Las Vegas tomorrow. And we'll get to deal with airline security. Oh, boy.
Oh, yes. And that means you'll miss the Mosin explosion. Oh, no.
Well, if they try to do anything to my specialized shoes, there may be an explosion.
Oh, my goodness.
As a matter of fact, I have a letter from my podiatrist, just in case they decide that they have to figure out what's going on inside those heavy heels.
Oh.
Heavy soles.
Okay. Well, that sounds like you're well prepared. I've got a couple of trips coming up to the U.S. One to the International Association of Audio Information Services in Minneapolis in May, and then of course to convention in Houston. So no doubt I'll get my share of American security soon enough.
We're going to try to go. We're going to try to go out to Houston in June.
Cool.
Yeah, we're gonna give it a whirl.
Good on you. Oh, well, if we see you there, that'd be fantastic.
Great, great.
All right. Well, enjoy Las Vegas.
Oh, we shall. We really will.
All right.
Okie doke.
See you later.
Sure, Jonathan.
Bye. Of course, since we last spoke, I think since we last spoke, the Ray Charles slot machines have been announced. Are they in Las Vegas? I think they might be. Ray Charles has given his name, lent his brand, if you will, to a new breed of slot machines, and they are accessible. Yes, accessible slot machines. I suppose that Mr. Charles can test out these slot machines by extracting just a fraction of the millions that he's earned in revenues from his astounding musical career and feeding it to the slot machines. How interesting. I wonder if we can get a couple of sample slot. Yeah, we last year we had the Bank of America exhibiting a talking ATM, so could we please have a couple of accessible slot machines for the ACB convention in Houston? Wouldn't that just be so good? The board is free. If you'd like to give us a call, you will get straight through. In fact, I think someone has just done that. They have. So we'll put them straight on the old internet. Wireless. Hello, this is Blindline.
Hello, Jonathan.
Hi.
Hey, this is Wayne from Texas.
Oh, it's Wayne from Texas. How are you, man?
Yes. I'm good. I'm just sitting here thinking that this probably a good question to throw out to you, since you seem to be in adaptive technology / general technology extraordinaire here.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm gonna disappoint you with a build up like that, but go ahead.
Well, maybe so, but you know, the build up was good.
Yeah, it was.
I'm going to a I finally got my state agency to allow me to have one of those general adaptive technology reviews at least, just about. And I'm going to be looking at Braille displays, and initially I wanted to get a review of, be able to look at different types of note-takers with Braille displays. And they didn't seem too hot on that idea, but they let me have the review anyway, so I can't bash them too much. But they also suggested, which warmed me up to the idea rather quickly, that I look at braille displays that you hook up to your computer.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, here's the $6 million question. I wanted to find out, I want to ask you which one's the best, because I know I won't get a roundabout answer that way. So instead, I'll ask you which ones that you might like or something like that for like a, I probably can only ask for a 40 cell, but if I get lucky, I might fit either with a 65 or an 80 cell braille display from my computer. Which one works well with the, and just, I don't know, feels good and overall works pretty well.
So, does that mean that if I answer this question, you give me $6 million?
Well, over, let's see, I'm 26.
Yes.
The average person lives to about 70. Yeah, over the next 34 some odd years.
Oh, cool. That's all right. Okay. I'll probably cark it long before you, but anyway.
Well, this will have part of it, though.
I don't have a lot of personal experience with the new braille displays that are out there, but I have been reading Freedom Scientific have one either out or about to come out called the Focus, which is supposed to have some nice features, and if you're a JAWS user, there's some good interaction going on there. I also read that the Vario is quite a cool braille display. I couldn't even tell you who makes the Vario, but I know a couple of people here who have Varios, and they love them. They're apparently quite compact. They fold up nicely, and they've got nice, crisp, clean cells. And the other one that I did read quite a bit about recently was that Pulse Data Humanware have a new braille display, and you know what? Someone's going to rescue me, I hope, and ring me and let me... You know?
I don't know what it is.
Something the, Star?
Yeah, Braille Star.
Braille Star. Oh, there you go. And that one I did read about quite recently, so that's fresh in my memory. And I understand that it has some memory that you can use it like a scratch pad, so you can actually braille on this one. Its primary function is to connect, and your laptop or whatever can, or your keyboard can sit on the top, and you can use it as a braille display. But if you need to, you can download the document into the braille display itself, disconnect it from the PC, and take it away. So it's by no means got all of the bells and whistles of a braille note or that family, but it does have some basic scratch pad functionality and some onboard memory, and that sounds rather nice.
Yeah, that sounds helpful for I'm beginning to get into website construction, and it sounds like that might help. I might have some usability there.
Yeah, well, anywhere where you might start a document on your PC, and perhaps you need to get on a bus and things like that and take it, then it could be good. I'm very disappointed that the Braille Note does not have a 40-cell version. I think going for the 32 cells, well, I suppose it's keeping the cost down. I really would like to have seen a 40-cell version of the Braille Note display. You can always hang on a bit longer and see what this new Packmate's going to be like, but of course, they're going to do the voice stuff before they do the braille.
Yeah, I listened to different portions and kind of pieced them together when main menu was rerunning about the Packmate, and I got excited about it, and I must say they're going in the right direction by including like the Pocket Word and Pocket Excel and that kind of thing. But I kind of liked when they mentioned the proposed battery life of 12 to 18 hours. 18 doesn't sound too bad, but I can't imagine my note taker talked it out after 13 hours. And I can get around 20 on my typing speed.
Well, we are rather spoiled, though. I mean, you take a standard laptop away with you, and you're going to only be getting about 3.5 to 4 hours on one battery as a rule.
Yeah, I know. I first time I typing speed can touch up to a full stretch as many minutes and hours as I could get. You know, it lasted me 35 hours.
Yeah.
I didn't have to charge it for a whole month.
Good. I had this company that looked interesting, but I didn't know enough about them, and I wasn't prepared to take the risk. But they're a company here in New Zealand, and they let you build your own laptop from the ground up, basically. You specify exactly what you want in it. And I said to them, so could you build me a laptop without a screen? And they sort of coughed and fell on the floor and, what would you want to, because we were talking on the phone, you know, and I said, well, I'm a blind person, and I figure that if we could take the screen out of the equation, then I could get a whole heap more battery life out of it. And they actually said, well, you know, you'd obviously need some sort of monitor card in there, because the system's not going to like not having a video card. But they said, well, yeah, we don't see why you couldn't have one without a screen. But then I thought, well, you know, everybody gets into a scrape sooner or later where for some reason the computer's gone into the BIOS or safe mode or something stupid, and you need to ask a human reader what's going on. So I didn't have the courage in the end to get this laptop without the screen, but I reckon that would have given me quite a lot longer battery life.
Yeah. If nothing else, it would have been great fun to get someone's hopes built up. Wow, that looks like a great computer. Oh, there's no screen on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, I think it's got potential, the whole concept, but, yep, I wasn't prepared to do that. So are you going to go and, how do you sleep, by the way? How do you sleep? Are you going to go into the laboratory at Harvard?
I was listening to that, I've actually had a hard time this semester with I'm in college still.
Yeah.
I've had a hard time with insomnia, and at first I was worried about, I think, whether I was going to be able to find a reader, and then I just got in the habit. And, you know, I've been going to sleep in several hours. It's like my sleep has compacted instead of gotten longer.
Mm.
I sleep a few hours and get up at 2 or 3, and I'm wide awake, and then go back to sleep at 5 or 6 or 7, or even later, and sleep for a few more hours, and I'm up by 12.
Yeah.
And most of my classes aren't until like late in the day anyway, so it hasn't really, except for a few times, and hasn't disrupted that kind of thing. But I just recently mentally threw up my hands and went out and got a bottle of melatonin, because I've been going to see a doctor on my campus's health center, and, you know, he's not sure what to do. It's now looking to me like he's going through his options and checking things off, and he's giving me Benadryl and Ambien, and even suggested that I go see a psychiatrist, which I was overwhelmed.
That's amazing. See, that's the trouble. That really is the trouble, that it's so difficult for blind people who have this problem to get proper help.
Mm-hmm. I didn't find out till 95. I lost my sight in 86, late 86. And I remember shortly after that happened, I don't know what the time length was, but I'm thinking it was like maybe in several weeks, I started having the sleep disorder, and my clock was screwed up, and it took me several years to get it back, and I didn't know what was going on. My parents thought I was being lazy.
Yes.
Because I'd fall asleep at 7 at night and wake up at 1:30 in the morning, and then get tired at 1 in the afternoon. I remember my science teacher in 7th grade sending a note home with me to my parents saying, I don't know if there's something wrong with me or whatever, but he fell asleep on my class. And that did. So it wasn't until like 6 or 7 years ago until I was taking a psych class, and I found out from my psychology teacher that there really is a sleep disorder out there. And I was like, hey, that makes sense.
It's real, all right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, nice to hear from you, and we'll look forward to keeping in touch. I'll be fascinated to find out what you end up with in the Braille department.
Yeah, they said that the note taker didn't go over too well, which is I have access to Braille and Braille imposters on my campus, which my point on that was that's great to have it after class, but I need it during class. But it sounds like that they would really, me getting a Braille display from my computer, that'd be very justifiable, so I might just go ahead and ask for that and maybe pick up the note taker on my own later on or something like that, you know.
Well, good luck, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right.
Okay.
Have fun.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Let's go to what I think will be our lucky last caller for today. Hi, this is Blind Line.
Hi, Jonathan. TC here.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I've just downloaded something new. I've downloaded WinZip. I really wanted it to compress my Handy Bits voice message. I don't know how that's going to work out. I was talking about it not doing it very well, even though those compressed boxes were checked, and somebody said, well, did you ever think about zipping it before you sent it? And I said, well, I don't have a zip program, and I don't know how to use one. And I downloaded that, and I don't know. I get a lot of different answers. In one case, I've been told not to use it to compress .wav Handy Bits files, but then, you know, because it might be larger, but then I've been told by a friend on PalTalk that it would compress it and save time on the Internet and making it smaller, but then when the person unzipped it, it goes back to full size. If it didn't, they couldn't read it or listen to it or whatever.
I would be very surprised if Handy Bits files compress much at all, because I imagine that they're already compressed. It's like if you zip up an MP3 file, for instance, you generally don't get any space saving, apart from a few bytes maybe, because the file is already compressed, and I suspect that that's what will happen with Handy Bits files.
Well, you know, I have the evaluation program of WinZip 8.1, and I've been thinking about dumping it, you know, before the time comes up to pay the $29, but one person has advised me to keep it because you can do a lot with it, and the JAWS Lightliest, you know, for a while when I go to that zip and email, JAWS wasn't reading any of the fields, and then I found out it was because Winamp and Windows Explorer are both in the way. If you close Windows Explorer and Winamp after you've selected the file and all like that, then it comes up. Then WinZip brings Outlook Express up, it reads them fine.
WinZip is a wonderful program. There you go. I'm sounding like a salesman again. I bought it a long, 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 long time ago. I've never had to pay a cent to upgrade it. I think I can't even remember the first version I had of it, but it was a long time ago. And new versions come out, and I get to upgrade for free, and it does a great job. I really like WinZip.
Well, you know, I guess it's probably all right, but, you know, I've been on the Internet for 3.5 years, and I've never had occasion to download a zip program or download a zip file. You know, when I had that talk center, and it was running in the startup menu, and everybody was wanting to send me all kinds of files to get it not to do that. You know, I'm using Windows 95, and I come to find out all I had to do was go to the taskbar options and go to programs and in the startup folder press the space bar on remove, and that took it out.
Yep, that's right. Hey, I'm out of time, but I appreciate you calling in, and no doubt we'll speak to you in the very near future, and good luck with your WinZip.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
See ya. And that brings Blind Line to a close. Thanks to all who participated. Thanks especially to Dr. Stephen Lockley, who gave us such a fascinating time talking about sleep. I hope some of it has helped you. And Stephen's address again, if you really need to get in touch with him now, is S. Lockley, that's S-L-O-C-K-L-E-Y at hms.harvard.edu. That's S. Lockley at hms.harvard.edu. This has been Blind Line. I'm off to the dentist.
For the latest breaking news stories, visit the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org. All the news, all the time. From the world's leading news organizations like CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the Wall Street Journal, and more. That's all the news, all the time, in the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org.